was initially chosen to head the new body, an appointment that Lord Falkner termed a corruption of British constitution. After backlash against the government's attempts to subsume public health experts under track and trace management, NIHB will now become the UK Health Security Agency, UKHSA, headed by Dr. Jenny Harris. Understandably, the creation of UKHSA and abolition of PHE has upset dedicated public professionals across the health service. Another policy decision that may strengthen the cronies' approach adopted during the pandemic is the Health and Social Care White Paper, which was published in February this year and spun as a set of policies that would unravel Andrew Lancy's 2012 Health and Social Care Act. The White Paper sets out how Integrated Care Systems, ICS, will be rolled out, combining NHS Trust with GP services as commissioners from a single budget pot. These ICS bodies will no longer be required to put contracts out to tender, but can instead award them directly, creating opportunities for contracts to be awarded to politically connected firms. The campaigning think tank We Own It is concerned that these plans would embed the role of the private sector within the health service, but with less transparency and accountability over contracts. Indeed, GP services are an area where the private sector is taking an increasing interest, with U.S. health giants such as Centene Corporation buying up GP services through its UK arm, Operos Health. Campaigners are worried these ICS bodies will be unaccountable and profit-making, and that private providers could sit on their commissioning boards. It's not yet clear whether ICS board meetings will be public and subject to FOI requests. It's not just GP services that are an area of concern. In August last year, the government announced a four-year plan to spend £10 billion of taxpayers' money on private hospitals in order to clear NHS waiting list. This has been justified as an emergency measure to deal with a backlog. But the question remains why this money was used to fund private providers rather than NHS capacity. The health campaigner John Lister says the institutionalized use of private hospitals will likely leave the NHS weakened and could lead to long-term expansion of the private sector for elective care. This points to the core of the issue. Though ministers have sought to justify their decisions with reference to the exceptional circumstances of COVID-19, many of these decisions instead seem part of a longer-term plan to embed political appointees and private providers at the heart of the state. Rather than selling off the NHS outright, a decision politicians know would be unpopular. They are instead doing this through the back door, by stealth.
Iranians have taken to the polls to elect Ibrahim Raisi as their new president. A principalist, he has had a long career in Iran's judicial system, serving many decades in various capacities, and now rising to become the president-elect. So what does his candidacy tell us about what we can expect going forward in Iran? As anticipated, several Western politicians and naturally numerous outlets in foreign-speaking corporate media have sought to undermine the elections, rejecting them outright, using all sorts of colorful terms and descriptions. So what can we see going forward from the incoming Ra'isi administration, and what direction is Iran headed on the domestic and international fronts? And what were the efforts undertaken by Western actors to subvert the electoral process?
I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
On June 18th, 2021, millions of Iranians took to the polls to elect a new president. Seven candidates were slated to run after being approved by the Guardian Council, a 12-member body made up of jurists who vet legislation to make sure that it follows the Constitution and who are also responsible for vetting presidential candidates. In total, 28.6 million ballots were cast. Ra'isi, a principalist candidate, won in a landslide victory with 62% of the vote, totaling around 18 million votes. Now, turnout was around 49%, which is considered to be historically low compared to previous elections. This is something that critics have turned to, claiming a strong lack of participation in the political process. However, these critiques fail to take into account that the election took place during a pandemic, under sanctions, and is perfectly in line with most levels of turnout reported in other presidential elections in other countries. Now, Ra'isi had participated in the previous presidential election of 2017. He ran against the outgoing president, Rouhani. Ra'isi, who is a principalist, or as they say in the West, a so-called hardliner, served a long career in the judiciary as deputy chief justice, as attorney general, and finally, as the head of the judiciary before becoming the president-elect. The elections come at a sensitive time as Iran is battling the global coronavirus pandemic, which has been worsened by crippling sanctions imposed by the West. Simultaneously, talks have been ongoing in Vienna to potentially revive the Iran nuclear deal, or as it's known officially, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The United States pulled out of the nuclear agreement in 2018 under then-President Donald Trump, who proceeded to impose devastating sanctions on Iran, targeting its banking and oil sectors, among others, as part of the brutal maximum pressure campaign. Trump's tearing up of the deal and Biden's hesitation in re-entering it has made life difficult for Iranians all across the board and posed a significant political challenge for the outgoing President Rouhani, who had served the limit of 2 4-year terms. Now, some saw the United States' refusal to abide by the nuclear agreement and the consequent sanctions imposed by Trump as a tipping point in an election considered a defining moment between moderates or reformists and principalists like the incoming President Ra'isi. Reacting to the election results, the new Prime Minister of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, Naftali Bennett, gave the usual fear-mongering response about every Iranian president who takes office. He simply repeated the exact same discourse that we've heard over and over from Netanyahu and others before him, claiming that Iran is a threat and repeating the same lies about possession of nuclear weapons and so forth. Bennett said that Ra'isi's election was, quote, the last chance for the world to wake up before returning to the nuclear agreement, unquote. The Israeli occupation has long opposed the JCPOA, as well as Iran's support for the Axis of Resistance and Palestinian liberation. A United States spokesperson for the State Department was also quick to bash the elections, claiming that Iranians were, quote, denied a free and fair election. However, the U.S. reiterated its commitment in continuing indirect talks in Vienna to see the JCPOA re-implemented. Now, President-elect Ra'isi was widely expected to win before the elections took place. He was polling around 50 points ahead of his opponents on average in the weeks and months leading up to the election. In his first day since taking office, President-elect Ra'isi was asked if he would meet with Joe Biden, to which he replied a clear, resounding no. Now you see, when the outgoing administration engages in diplomacy as it did, the Americans do not reciprocate. They do not follow the JCPOA, nor do they respect their word, and simply vanish. And now when the incoming administration is still willing to engage in diplomacy, but also willing to look outwards, the Americans cry about so-called hardliners. You see, this is a never-ending propaganda war, and nothing Iranians do is enough, short of bending the knee, of course, to colonial interests. The usual suspects in mainstream corporate media, such as the BBC, Deutsche Welle, and CNN, have spoken at length for weeks, trying to discredit and undermine the elections in advance. They often mention the economic misery and woes that people are suffering in Iran without ever mentioning that this is directly a consequence of sanctions. They do the exact same thing when it comes to their reports on Syria and Venezuela and their elections. How can anyone take what these mainstream outlets say seriously when they do not even tell a basic truth like that? Now let's be clear, attempts to subvert Iran's elections are nothing new, and they're not just confined to the media. First of all, in 1953, the American and British intelligence services, the CIA and MI6, respectively, collaborated together to overthrow Iran's democratically elected Prime Minister, Mossadegh. Then they went and installed the Shah, who was strongly in favor of the West and catered to their economic and political interests. And during this time, the West had no problem with him and even wanted to provide Iran with nuclear technology because he was doing what they wanted. However, once the Islamic Revolution happened in 1979 and the Iranian people took back their country, then immediately the United States began attacking Iran through various mediums and channels and has tried to undermine the Islamic Republic ever since. The U.S. has targeted Iran with sanctions. It has supported Saddam Hussein in a war against Iran, providing him with chemical weapons. The U.S. accused Iran of having nuclear weapons itself, and still does, and supports Israel's assassinations and nuclear sabotage, and has directly meddled in Iran's presidential elections several times. In 2009, the State Department worked with Twitter directly, requesting that they postpone any maintenance on the website, just in order to bolster efforts by dissidents who claimed that the election results were fraudulent. Again, a similar playbook that we've seen deployed against Bolivia and other countries that are on the list of countries targeted for regime change, or also called the Axis of Evil. Every U.S. president has tried to interfere in Iran's politics. More recently, just in January 2020, Donald Trump assassinated and murdered General Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force, which helped to defeat Daesh and Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria. Trump and Biden have both pirated and stolen fuel shipments from Iran, which have been sent to help other countries like Venezuela or Syria. Secretary of State Blinken repeats the same rhetoric on Iran, the same baseless fear-mongering as Mike Pompeo and all his predecessors. So the real question here is not what has changed in Iran, but when is there going to be change in the attitude of the West towards Iran? This attempt to subvert Iran's political apparatus is not just confined to the elections that took place, but spans multiple decades and is an ongoing effort by the West. This is what people must understand. And considering that the Americans and British have not only meddled in Iran's politics, but directly couped the country and installed a puppet before, I mean, other endeavors to undermine and subvert the Iranian political apparatus should come as no surprise to anyone who knows their history.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
I'm Richard Medhurst. Joining me is Sayed Mohammad Marendi, head of North American Studies at the University of Tehran. He's a great friend and a great friend of the show. Thank you for coming on, Professor. It's really a pleasure to have you on again.
Thank you very much, Richard, for having me.
So, Professor, you know, I wanted to start talking about the elections, the presidential elections in Iran. You know, one term that we hear a lot is this hardliner in the media. Apparently, they don't like using the word principalist or conservative. They prefer to go with hardliner. I wanted to ask you, you know, what do they mean by that exactly? Is that just in regards to the United States, isn't it?
They don't consider Iranians to be hardliners towards Argentina or Nicaragua or Venezuela or South Africa or India or Pakistan or China. It's just when Iranian leaders stand up to the United States and say no to appeasement. That's where they become hardliners. And even the term conservative is somewhat misleading, because in Iran, those who are actually called conservatives, what they themselves call the principalists, they are culturally speaking, more conservative. But with regards to economics, they are left-leaning. So it's very different from in Western countries, I think. In Iran, the reformists, the moderates, are more culturally liberal, especially the reformists. But economically speaking, they're also more liberal and supportive of free markets and capitalism and big business and that sort of thing.
I'm glad you explained that, because I think it gets construed a lot when it's spoken about in the Western media, and people don't really understand the nuances. And speaking of the Western media, they've talked a little bit about the Iran nuclear deal, about the JCPOA, and saying that they've decried Trump pulling out of it, and not because he put crippling sanctions on Iran and ruined people's lives, but apparently because this allegedly helped Raisi win, right? He won some 18 million votes. They're upset that this supposedly dashed any hopes of reforms. What do you make of this kind of language?
To a degree, it's correct that the United States always fails those who put faith in it. It always fails them. No matter who they are and where they are, the Americans have a great tradition of betraying those who trust it. And in Iran, I'm not saying that the current administration, the outgoing administration, trusted the United States. But I think that although some people like Dr. Zarif, I respect a great deal, but I believe that they were, to a degree, a bit too optimistic about U.S. intentions. And Iran has had a history with the United States where on every occasion that the Iranians actually agreed to sit down with them, they betrayed Iran. When in the 1980s, the Iranians agreed to help the Americans free Americans in Beirut that were being held by different groups, the Iranians had to go in and to, spend from their pocket, not necessarily financially, but credibility to get these people freed. And then afterwards, the Americans behaved even worse towards Iran. After the war, the Iranians gave, despite the fact that the Americans gave Saddam Hussein help, the Americans gave help and the Europeans gave him chemical weapons, the military intelligence to use it, as well as the political cover to get away with it. But the Iranians, in order to create a more favorable environment for rapprochement, they gave the Americans an oil field in the Persian Gulf. They gave it to Conoco. And after a couple of years of negotiations that the Americans were well aware of, when they were signing the agreement, the Americans imposed sanctions. Or in Afghanistan, when Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were involved in 9/11, the Taliban wasn't involved, but they were in bed with Al-Qaeda in general, Al-Qaeda, the Iranians helped to overthrow these two groups. Yet the Americans then immediately went and called Iran a part of the axis of evil. And the list goes on. So Iran has this history, and I myself was skeptical about the U.S. ever implementing the nuclear deal, and I must add that the U.S. never did implement it. This is one of the myths that goes around, is that Obama implemented the deal. He never did. The Iranians did, and Obama dragged his feet. And until the very end of his presidency, the Iranian central head of the Iranian Central Bank, who was a part of the moderate or reformist administration of Mr. Rouhani, said that we can't do anything. So Iran's mistrust of the United States goes back a long way, and it's based upon very clear evidence. And I think that Mr. Raisi, when he says that we can't trust the United States, now people recognize that he was right.
What do you say to people who look at the turnout? I believe it was around 49%, and they say that this is extremely low, and it's I believe someone on Western media told you it was a failure of establishment, or they called it something ridiculous like that. What do you say to those people who criticize the low turnout?
Well, we just had very important elections in France, and the turnout I think was in the mid-30s. And so is that a failure of the establishment? Does that mean that France is about to collapse or is going to fall apart? Is there going to be regime change? 49% is not great. But A, there's a pandemic. And according to polls that were carried out in Iran before the elections, roughly 10 to 12% of Iranians said they're not going to vote because of the coronavirus. So if we add that, that would make it like 58%, 60%, which is decent. 49% or 48.8%, I think, is the accurate number. Is not great, but it's enough. And in the United States, the elections are usually in the low 50s, presidential elections. This time around, of course, because the fate of the United States was being determined, apparently, so said the two sides. The turnout was in the mid-60s, but usually it's lower. And the 2018 elections, and most probably the 2022 elections, will probably be in the 30s. So there's nothing strange about the turnout in Iran. In fact, despite the pandemic, despite the maximum pressure campaign, where people in Iran have really been put under a lot of pressure, and the fact that there's been 24-hour anti-Iranian propaganda being spread by BBC Persian, VOA Persian, Deutsche Welle Persian, Iran International, which is a Saudi channel, and a host of other TDP channels, in addition to an online army that's most of them are based in Albania. They are MEK terrorist organization funded by the Americans and others. They too have been carrying out psychological warfare, and all sorts of websites and so on that are, there's more anti-Iranian material out there being beamed into the country, being sent into the country by Western governments and their allies than there is counter news and information being produced inside the country. That's how massive this campaign is. And one of the extraordinary things is that Iran International, which is a Saudi channel, has these Iranian traders working for them, and they're calling for people to boycott the election and saying that it's undemocratic.
President-elect Raisi has been touted as very anti-corruption. He is the head of the judiciary. And, you know, someone asked him if he's ready to meet with President Biden. He said no, which, you know, I know how it's going to be interpreted in the West, but I wanted a more, a better explained answer from you, if you may. You know, what do you make of his response? And also, just were there any other opening remarks from him that stood out to you, which, kind of just stood out to you or surprised you?
Well, why should he want to see Biden? Biden was the vice president of the Obama regime when they implemented these maximum pressure sanctions in the first place. It wasn't Trump who started this. It was Obama and Biden who were targeting women and children in Iran. And then when ultimately the United States was forced to accept Iran's right to enrichment and they signed the deal, then Americans still didn't abide by their commitments. They still tried to put pressure on women and children. Then, of course, Biden, when he was criticizing Trump, he said that he disagrees with Trump's policy on Iran. But ever since he's been president, he's been continuing the same policy. So he is targeting women and children. He's a murderer. Forget Syria, forget Yemen, forget Venezuela. Iran alone, these are crimes against humanity. But if you put Iran alongside all these other examples, it's just mind-boggling. So why would he be interested in seeing such a monster?
What do you think will be the most striking differences in domestic policy and equally in foreign policy between Raisi's government and Rouhani?
Well, my hope is that what President-elect Raisi has been saying is that he will move in this direction and he will turn things around. But I also think that his objective is to support local production, whether the private sector or the public, to decrease imports and to be more self-reliant, both economically and as well as in the agricultural sector. But also, I think with regards to foreign policy, I think he's going to tilt to the global south, to the East, East Asia, Central Asia, Russia, China, Latin America, especially with the fact that, you know, many, there are new rising powers. China is a rising power. Then they shouldn't expect Iran or anyone else to just sit behind the door and wait for them to open it. I think that's another mistake that the current administration or the outgoing administration made. Not that the foreign minister or the foreign ministry made, I mean the government in general, is that they were pinning too much hope on the U.S. implementing the deal. I think the incoming administration, hopefully, this is my hope, that they will say, okay, you know, if you are willing to implement the deal, fine, we'll implement our side of the bargain, but we're not going to wait for you anymore. We're going to find new friends, we're going to strengthen our ties with other countries so that we need you less, and so that in future you will have fewer cards to hold when you want to pressure us. And the fact that the Americans are also putting pressure on the Russians and the Chinese and sanctioning them and antagonizing them and so on actually creates an incentive among these countries, all of these countries, to work closer with each other to stand up against American aggression and hegemony.
The fact of the matter is that the West regularly, actively subverts the elections and governments of other countries, particularly ones with vast resources or ones who don't bend the knee to their interests. Anyone who thinks otherwise is completely deluded or lying to themselves. This is a proven fact, and the annals of history can attest to that. From Latin America to Southeast Asia to West Asia to the Middle East, the United States and the European colonial powers have been trying to run the affairs of the Global South for centuries upon centuries. The Americans launched dirty wars on Syria. They pulled coups in Central America. They meddle in Iran's elections. Then they have the nerve to play the victim and whine about this made-up Russiagate scandal for 4 years? The hypocrisy could not be more staggering, nor better encapsulated than in U.S. President Joe Biden's own words. During his recent Geneva summit with Putin, Biden asked, how would the world view the United States if it went around the world meddling in other countries' affairs? Well, there's no need to wonder, because that's precisely what the United States has always done and still does. The Americans want to talk about meddling? They've meddled in virtually every country on Earth. The Americans want to talk about election interference? They have interfered and cooed from one continent to the next. The Americans want to talk about human rights abuses? They are the biggest human rights abusers on the planet. Look at the wars that they have done. Look at Guantanamo Bay. Look at the sanctions. They want to talk about democracy? They have one of the most undemocratic societies in the world. Their entire government is owned and bought by corporations. So we're not going to sit here and tolerate this hypocritical nonsense, these people talking about free and fair elections when they themselves do not even know the first thing about free and fair elections. We're not going to tolerate them talking about human rights when they do not even respect human rights themselves. This idea that only white Western countries have legitimate elections and functioning democracies and political institutions is ridiculous. This is a racist colonial mindset that thinks that the West is superior and everyone else doesn't know how to do anything and must conform to Western-styled liberal ideas. This is preposterous. The West does not actually care about democracy. The West doesn't care about human rights or civil liberties. The United States and Britain are responsible for so much bloodshed, for countless coups. They've helped install right-wing dictatorships. They helped create Al-Qaeda. They gave rise to the conditions that gave birth to Daesh. So when they come here and talk about a country not having legitimate elections or institutions, what they really mean is that this is a country that they can't control. That's what this is about. Domination. When a country is actually independent, when it exercises its sovereignty, this angers them. This angers the imperialists. And so they come and they attack with bombs, they attack with sanctions, with propaganda, and so forth to get their way. It has nothing to do with electoral processes and transparency or human rights or who the winner is. This is all about maintaining empire. This is all about upholding their economic interests and the interests of their multinational corporations and imposing their rule, imposing colonial imperialist rule over other countries, period. And this is precisely why they go after and why they attack the axis of resistance. Don't delude yourself for 1 minute. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
If Trudeau is indeed genuine in his desire to root out anti-Muslim terrorism from Canada, he should start by cleansing his own party of hate speech and all attempts at criminalizing Islam and Muslims and ban hate speech against Muslims in the media, says Ramzi Barood, journalist, in an article titled, Words Alone Will Not End Anti-Muslim Terror in Canada. Stay tuned for more. The killing of a Muslim family on June 6 in Ontario, Canada, again presented an opportunity for Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to brand himself as a voice of reason and communal harmony. However, Trudeau's amicable and reassuring language is designed to veil a sinister reality which has for many years hidden the true face of Canadian politics. This was a terrorist attack motivated by hatred and the heart of one of our communities, Trudeau told Parliament 2 days after a Canadian terrorist, Nathaniel Veltman, deliberately struck a Canadian Muslim family at an intersection in London, Ontario. Only a young boy survived the attack, which killed his parents, sister and grandmother. The 9-year-old boy remains in critical condition. The Prime Minister, whose brand of friendly and progressive liberal facade is often juxtaposed with the rise of conservative populist politics in much of the Western Hemisphere, went on speaking as if an activist advocating human rights and equality for all. Trudeau said, if anyone thinks racism and hatred don't exist in this country, I want to say this. How do we explain much violence to a child in a hospital? How can we look families in the eye and say Islamophobia isn't real? Ironically, it took years of pressure and concerted lobbying from many civil society organizations, progressive and Muslim groups to finally convince Trudeau to designate January 29th as the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Islamophobia. This specific date was chosen to commemorate the terrorist attack by a Canadian citizen on a Quebec City mosque in 2017. 6 Canadian Muslims were killed and 19 others were injured in the hate crime in the Grand Mosque. That attack, too, was an opportunity for Trudeau to rail against terrorism and hate. Ultimately, it was all empty rhetoric, as the Canadian government has done little to rectify the dangerous phenomena. This lack of meaningful action makes the government complicit in the rising Islamophobia and hate crimes in Canada. By way of explaining his rejection of recognizing January 29th as the Day of Action on Islamophobia, Trudeau told Radio Canada that while it is important to underline intolerance directed at people of faith, he wished to avoid that type of backlash that we have seen when we take these kinds of actions, since the perpetrators of hate crimes are still a small intolerant minority. Jingoism aside, Trudeau was essentially arguing that recognition and action against Islamophobia were unnecessary as they may give too much attention to a small and hateful minority. Trudeau is utterly wrong. A report submitted by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion, or BRIEF, in November last year showed that a majority of Canadians, about 52%, believe that Muslims cannot be trusted, while 42% feel that discrimination against Muslims, racism, is mainly the fault of Muslims themselves. The UN findings are part of a long trajectory of violence and racism targeting Canadian Muslims. A Gallup poll published in 2011 has already debunked the small minority claim. Canadian Muslims, 48%, along with American Muslims, 52%, feel disrespected within their societies. This disrespect manifests itself in numerous ways, much of it unreported, occasionally making news when it translates into outright violence. Indeed, there is plenty of that too. Official Canadian police reports demonstrated that hate crimes against Canada's Muslims are on the rise, with 166 such incidents reported in 2018, 181 in 2019, and so on, with violent crimes becoming more intense and bloodier with time. Sadly, anti-Muslim terrorism in Canada is likely to increase in the future, not only because hate crimes statistics show an upward trajectory, but because anti-Muslim sentiments often take center stage in government and media as well. Negative depictions of Islam and Muslims in Canadian media must not be grouped under the designation of mainstream Western media bias, as media fear-mongering is penetrating the very psyche of large sections of Canadian society. Many Canadian politicians, even in Trudeau's own party, often exploit this alarming phenomena to feed their political ambitions. Various Canadian provinces have either passed or drafted laws that specifically target Canada's Muslim minorities. For example, Quebec's Bill 62, which restricts the wearing of niqab in public buildings. Outrageously, the bill, which was passed by Quebec's Liberal government in October 2017, followed the bloody attack on the Grand Mosque in Quebec City. Instead of fighting Islamophobia, Quebec's official provided it with a legal and moral justification. While feeding Islamophobia at home, Trudeau persistently rages against human rights violators in China, the West Asia, and around the world. As Chinese columnist Mu Lu rightly argued in Global Times, Canada uses human rights as a stick to beat others, while the same claim can be also made regarding the misuse of human rights as a foreign policy tool by other Western leaders. Trudeau is often successful in presenting his human rights concerns as genuine. If Trudeau is indeed genuine in his desire to root out anti-Muslim terrorism from Canada, he should start by cleansing his own party of hate speech and all attempts at criminalizing Islam and Muslims, and ban hate speech against Muslims in the media. Terrorism will not end as a result of pomposity, but through real action. Trudeau seems to have much of the former and none of the latter.
Around the World with Reporters.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah began his televised speech by denouncing the U.S. administration's decision to seize and block dozens of website domains connected to Iranian and regional media outlets.
It's not coincidental that these websites which were seized are media outlets that had a major role in supporting the Palestinians in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. They all have a clear position from the Zionist enemy and the American hegemony over the region. These outlets are critical of sedition and terrorism, specifically Takfiri terrorism. This gives us and the free people of the world another piece of evidence against the false claims of the U.S. administration, which claims to defend freedom of speech and freedom of opinion.
Said Nasrallah also criticized U.S. statements that attempt to incite the Lebanese army against the resistance. Said Nasrallah noted that U.S. officials have tried to justify their humble support to the Lebanese army by stressing that this assistance is aimed at giving the army leverage to confront Hezbollah. This, Said Nasrallah says, will not happen since the National Army is the main guarantor for peace in the country. On another note, the resistance leader explained how Hezbollah has been exerting an effort to mediate talks for the formation of the cabinet.
All efforts in the country must come together to form a government and to pull the country out of this dilemma. Since Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri was named by most members of parliament, we have been working on a quick formation of the cabinet. We have been supportive of an initiative from Speaker Barry, and we will work on finding resolutions to the last few disagreements in the talks.
Experts believe Said Nasrallah's words and sufferings of the people lining up at gas stations and pharmacies should be an incentive for the officials to find solutions.
Said Nasrallah said there is no magical solution, and he stressed that the crisis should be disintegrated and resolved one by one until the government is reestablished. If we want to go back to the state where the government collects taxes and the citizens practice their rights and responsibilities in paying taxes, where there are investments in the country again and we create more job opportunities, all of these issues need political stability, and political stability will be the only first step to genuinely solve the many crises in the country.
Said Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah has accomplished all the administrative and logistic preparations for importing gasoline and fuel from Iran to Lebanon in case the state fails to cover the fuel shortage. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Luxurious Avonfield apartments located at Park Lane, Mayfair in London. The family of thrice-elected former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, has been staying here for decades. A trial court sentenced Nawaz Sharif for 10 years in 2018 for owning these flats, which the judge found were purchased through money laundering and ill-gotten money. Sharif left Pakistan in late 2019 after being released, allegedly on the basis of false medical reports, to once again reside in this palatial residence. To the shock of the former Prime Minister, Back in Pakistan, now a high court set aside his appeal and upheld the verdict of the trial court. Sharif was declared a fugitive of law by the court when he backtracked his commitment with the high court to return home within a few weeks after the medical treatment. This has now led High Court to reject his appeal for failing to return home despite his earlier pledge with the court.
I think Nawaz Sharif should not have fled the country and now that he has been declared as fugitive or an absconder, that's not good for him. That will actually soil his political reputation. For now, you know, Nawaz Sharif is in trouble and politically, I think, his position has become more precarious.
The High Court verdict has come as a major political victory for ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan, who came into power in 2018 with the pledge to prosecute Nawaz Sharif and other opposition leaders on corruption charges.
This verdict is a victory for the people of Pakistan, and this verdict is the victory to the ruling party's anti-corruption campaign. We believe Nawaz Sharif must return the money he looted from the people of Pakistan.
The former Prime Minister still has one chance to appeal with the Supreme Court of Pakistan to set aside his conviction. But for that to happen, Sharif must return home. Otherwise, legal experts believe that the top court may also reject his appeal. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Shocking footage filmed on the 18th of June, Iran's election day, shows Iranian expats being attacked outside polling stations up and down the UK. Victims included women and the elderly, the perpetrators, supporters of anti-Iran terrorist groups, including the MEK, communists, and Shah royalists.
Videos released on social media show fanatic protesters hurling Islamophobic abuse and even physically assaulting voters in cities including Birmingham, Manchester and here in London too.
One victim reached out to tell us about her ordeal.
As soon as I got near the embassy, I was wearing the hijab, obviously, and the crowd started roaring and screaming. And they got louder as they saw me, obviously, going to vote. Calling me names, calling my family names, cursing my mother, my father. I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously you couldn't understand Farsi. He's telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now. I was so shaking. Yeah. Since then, I've suffered with anxiety since that day. I said to myself, I should have left. But I stood my ground. I said, why should I leave? And the people coming, I said, why are you calling me names? They said, we call you names because you deserve it.
Britain boasts about being a defender of democracy on the world stage. But these violent scenes suggest that the UK failed miserably to protect democratic rights of Iranians inside its own borders. Despite these attempts, Iran's election went ahead with President-elect Sayed Ibrahim Raisi coming out on top. Robert Carter, London.
It's the world's second most populous nation, and the figures of COVID-19 infection cases are rising on a daily basis. The cities are bustling as the country is picking up pace as the world's fastest growing major economies. But in all this hustle bustle and race of survival, an important aspect of life is on stake, and that is mental health. The second wave of COVID-19 has altered the lifestyle of millions across India who now are struggling in silence. Reports suggest more than 70% of those in the age group of 18 to 24 are suffering from some form of depression. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has ignited the crisis further, as many are facing financial and social hardships. According to psychological experts, economic and social pressures combined with the lack of appropriate mental health facilities is a major reason behind this new epidemic, which has now started exploding due to the coronavirus pandemic. Based on reports, the economic cost of mental illness in India is expected to be more than $1 trillion by 2030.
COVID-19 has impacted a lot. A lot means, you can say, everyone, almost everyone, because one or the other way, everyone has been affected, whether it's, you know, the infection has caused or, you know, the mental health or the other ways, because the businesses has shut down.
Health experts say all disorders are linked to a fast-paced lifestyle, stress, complexities of living, breakdown of support systems, and challenges of economic instability. They say the COVID pandemic has added fuel to the fire with depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, and substance abuse being common in most people.
One must go for yoga daily. Yoga, you have to do proper yoga. Then breathing exercises are there. They have to do at least half an hour to 1 hour so that the blood circulation towards brain increases.
COVID-19 lockdowns impacted people from all walks of life and age groups. Now they're finding it hard to deal with consequences of the pandemic-induced lockdowns. Many turn to drugs and alcohol, while others prefer religious therapies and yoga. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Britain's travel industry is frustrated and nervous. Protesting around the country on June 23rd, people whose jobs rely on international travel, now only working at 10% capacity. They want more countries on the so-called green list to save jobs.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And then why put some on the green list and then take them off? Like, say we booked a holiday to Portugal. We were supposed to be there this week and we've cancelled it because it went amber and it was going to cost another £1,000 in COVID tests.
The restrictions are now crazy. So I'm stuck in the London, not in the London, in England for quite a long time. And I wish to travel back to my country as I haven't seen my mum for 2 years.
Green means arrivals to the UK do not need to self-isolate, but have to take a test before and after they travel. Amber means self-isolating at home for up to 10 days. And red means quarantining at a hotel paid for by the travelers.
In the past few days, some government officials suggested double-jabbed passengers from amberless countries could be exempt from quarantining.
We're also looking to see how we can replace the protections that are currently there with the restrictions, with protections that come from the vaccine, with respect to international travel as well. But it is more difficult freeing up international travel.
And difficult it will be when it comes to the willingness of other countries to let British tourists in. Germany has called on all EU countries to make British travelers quarantine on arrival to slow the spread of the Delta variant. All this as the UK recorded more than 16,000 new COVID cases Wednesday, the highest figure since early February, most of them caused by the Delta variant first discovered in India. There were also 19 deaths. The travel industry is yet to react to the government announcement, but with countries moving up and down the UK government's list, British travelers have to think again before they take a gamble. Saeed Puriza, London.
As anti-Westminster sentiment continues to rise, another part of Britain is entering the fight to break away from the UK. Cornwall, located on the southwest of the island, is witnessing the start of a new pro-independence advocacy group which aims to revive a lesser-known campaign for Cornish independence.
All Under One Banner's Kerr now is the latest branch in a wider organisation which already has roots in Scotland and Wales. In both countries, All Under One Banner has achieved significant success in opening up the debate on independence. Locals in Cornwall are hoping to achieve the same.
Many Cornish people, who are recognised as a Celtic minority, have various grievances with the English-centric London rule, including a lack of funding and a systematic destruction of an ancient culture.
That's a good way of explaining it. We're a long colonised place, possibly longer than the Welsh, who also probably feel that they've been colonised as well. But we've recovered that history, and that's one of our greatest successes. And the greatest challenge now is decolonizing the history and explaining it to Anglo-Saxon ears.
In past campaigns, activists have been branded as nationalists who hate the English, a claim rejected by locals.
Got no problem with the English or with any other nationality at all. What I have a problem with is the way that possibly we are represented through them, and the way sometimes we are talked down to and treated by them. But no, there's no problem at all. We have so many friends from all over the world down here.
For now, Cornish independence is a minority view, but lifelong campaigners believe things are changing.
I think we're already getting there in terms of greater autonomy, understanding the need for it. The next question is how to get it, and obviously there are political ways of getting it, but there's also a need for people to go out and campaign for it.
The idea of Scotland or Wales breaking away has sent shivers down number 10. This latest development in Cornwall will surely only worsen Downing Street's fears. Robert Carter, London.
The US Justice Department committed a new flagrant violation of the freedom of the press and blocked several regional outlets' websites, including the Yemeni channel Al Masira and Iran's Press TV, claiming they are linked to what it calls Iranian disinformation efforts. Yemenis condemned this move, saying it proves that the US calls for freedom of speech are lies.
The seizure of some of the websites affiliated with the resistance front comes amid the media war. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying since the beginning of its war on Yemen to cover up its crimes committed against Yemenis and to mislead world public opinion.
Yemen's Ministry of Information said the U.S. government seizure of a few websites confirmed the strength of the media of the resistance and proved that these websites revealed the true face of the U.S., including its participation in the brutal Saudi war on Yemen.
We condemn the seizure of some websites affiliated with the resistance front. This move shows that these websites have been strong enough to influence the American public opinion by releasing the realities on the ground. It reveals the falsehood of American claims about democracy and freedom of speech. Certainly, there are solutions to this blocking and the websites will be running again.
Ali Ashra'i, the manager of Al Masira website, said this move revealed the weakness of the U.S. even though it owns thousands of media outlets.
This step reveals the great weakness that the United States is suffering from, even though it owns thousands of websites, satellite channels, newspapers, and radio stations. However, it was unable to withstand a few channels with limited capabilities which convey the truth as it is and express the opinion of the free people in this world.
Experts believe that this step is part of a media war of the U.S. government against the media outlets of the resistance. They said these attacks will persist and the resistance access should be ready for further violations. Yemenis say the freedom of speech is a fundamental right for all free people of the world, and the United States has no right to deny individuals or communities this right. They believe that such attacks will promote the free media outlets to continue exposing the U.S. policies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention,